This is
KUT.
KUT, Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT Weekend for the second weekend of December 2019. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week. The city of Austin orders a sweeping probe of alleged racism and bigotry at the Austin Police Department.
The opportunity we have before us to take a system that's not working and make it right.
An Austin brain surgeon who died during a car race being remembered for his biggest wins off the track.
I was just in awe of this man.
And Rainy Street being shut down to cars and trucks on the weekend.
The main block where most of the bars are, that's going to be closed those three nights a week.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend.
We started getting concerned several weeks ago when we had a 100% increase in flu cases between week 44 and week 45.
This is Dr. Mark Escott. He's the Interim Health Authority and Medical Director for Austin Public Health.
Between week 45 and week 46, we had another 100% increase. And the last week of reporting, which is week 47, we had a 275% increase, which is turning out to be a very early peak to the flu season. Normally, we see that peak in January or February. This one's starting in November, which is unusually early for us.
Yeah, so the data they're looking at is delayed. And I spoke to him this week about the latest flu surveillance, which reflects information up to November 23rd. The flu is obviously a big deal, though, not only because it makes millions of Americans sick every year, but also because last flu season alone, the CDC said up to 60,000 people in the U.S. died from the flu. So I was wondering what the early peak of the flu season is going to mean for the rest of the flu season in the Austin area.
It's difficult to say. To some extent, we anticipated that this may happen. And the reason is because in the Southern Hemisphere, in Australia in particular, they had an unusually bad season. And similar to us, Australia had a peak 2 months earlier than the usual peak. Now, what happened there is it plateaued out for the duration of the season and then declined. It's a bit hard for us to tell now. Sometimes we'll see an initial peak and then a plateau, and then another second peak in the traditional time period. The thing that's concerning for us right now is primarily what we're seeing is influenza B, which is a bit unusual. Normally we see influenza A as part of these peaks, but we do have a concern that as we transition from flu B primarily to flu A, we'll see an additional peak, and that's more concerning because the symptoms associated with influenza A tend to be more severe, and we're more likely to see deaths and complications as a result of influenza A.
Good news is both those strains are in the flu vaccine.
That's correct. So all of the flu shots, including the flu mist, the nasal spray, are quadrivalent this year. So there's H1N1 coverage, H3N2, and then two types of influenza B, all of which is formulated based upon what's happening in other parts of the world at the time of the vaccine's creation.
Austin Public Health's weekly influenza surveillance report this week also found there were some outbreaks happening in local schools.
That's correct. So we've had two schools, one public, one private. One of those schools had 15% of their students were absent from school with influenza-like illness. The other one, 24%, which is unusually high, again, particularly this early in the season. One of those schools closed down for disinfecting. The other didn't close down, but increased their disinfection processes and then notified parents to keep their children home if they're sick and to encourage the flu immunization.
And that's the advice public health officials are giving everyone. Don't go to school or work if you think you might have the flu. And get the flu vaccine, especially if you're around the very young or the very old or people with compromised immune systems. There has not been any flu deaths recorded in Travis County so far this season, but in Texas, one baby has already died from the flu. The Austin City Council is ordering a sweeping probe of alleged racism and bigotry at the Austin Police Department, and it will include an audit of officers' social media accounts. KUT's Audrey McGlinchey has been reporting on this. Hello, Audrey.
Hi, Nathan.
How did all of this get started?
This particular discussion really started about a month ago when it became public that an assistant chief with APD, Justin Newsom, had abruptly resigned because two anonymous complaints had been filed against him, alleging that he had used on a continual basis a racist term for Black people over many years. Included in one of those complaints was also an allegation that another assistant chief, Troy Gay, had sent his son to gay conversion therapy, which is a scientifically discredited method for converting people who are gay to being straight. And so that prompted a discussion and a reaction from some city council members about, well, if there are people in our highest ranks at APD that are exhibiting racism and homophobia, that we really should look into how widespread this is in the department.
What happened at the city council meeting Thursday night?
So city council members unanimously approved a far-reaching audit into various layers of the police department, again, looking for examples of alleged racism, homophobia, sexism. And so what they're going to look at is really it's a lot. It's training materials, recruitment materials. It is, as you mentioned, social media posts of officers. It is data regarding police interactions with the public, data regarding police shootings, use of force. Again, a very, very wide-reaching audit into the police department.
You mentioned it was a unanimous vote by the city council. What did city council members say last night?
Council member Natasha Harper Madison, who is the only Black council member on the Austin City Council, spearheaded this measure and spoke several times. And her point was basically that this is a hard conversation that Austin needs to have right now, and we can't wait. And that for many people of color in the city, they've experienced racism at the hands of Austin police, and many people shared their personal experience last night, including the council member, and that for a lot of people, this is not a surprise that this happened, but that we have to do the work to figure out, again, how wide-reaching it is and if there's a root of the problem. Is it how we train officers? Is it the kind of officers we recruit?
Humans are fallible. We all mess it up sometimes. It just so happens that from a professional capacity, there are some folks for whom there is no margin of error. And so the goal of this resolution and talking to my colleagues over the last couple weeks, talking to the many, many bold, brave officers who took the time to come and talk to me about their experiences, former cadets who came and talked to me about their experiences. And it is my hope that this is simply a start. It is also my hope that folks don't leave here tonight feeling debilitated by anger or frustration. It is my hope that you leave here tonight feeling inspired by the opportunity we have before us to take a system that's not working and make it right.
Another council member, Mayor Pro Tem Delia Garza, actually expressed losing faith in Austin Police Chief Brian Manley.
I've expressed my family's background in the past and my support for public safety. My sister's a police officer. She's married to a police officer. I have cousins. I have uncles. My father was a firefighter, and I was an Austin firefighter. I have tremendous respect for our public safety, but repeated incidences by our department have really shaken my faith in many ways, and in some ways I've lost a lot of faith. I was an early supporter of Chief Manley, and I've been incredibly disappointed.
So what the city council approved last night, is that separate from what the city manager, Spencer Kronk, has hired someone to do?
Yeah. So as I mentioned last month, it became public that two high-ranking officers had been accused of racism and homophobia within the police department. And so as a response to that, the Austin city manager, Spencer Kronk, hired an outside investigator, a lawyer who has worked in Bexar County, to conduct interviews and investigate who knew about racism and homophobia, who allowed it to continue, and really, I guess, who is to blame for allowing a culture like that to exist in APD?
So if there are two tracks here in terms of an investigation audit, when do we get to see what the findings
are? Any of this information? Yeah, that's a great question. So the investigation brought forward by the city manager, which again is just focused on two people, is expected to be presented to city council by the end of January. And then city council members had asked that their department-wide investigation not begin until we see the results of this two-person specific investigation, which again will come at the end of January. So everything we've just talked about of what city council has asked for, again, won't start until the end of January.
What does the Austin Police Union have to say about this?
Generally, they've been supportive of this. For a while now, they've been talking about how they feel that Austin Police Chief Brian Manley holds his highest ranking officers to different standards than the rank and file of police, more, you know, patrolmen and women. They're generally welcoming an investigation into the two high ranking officers I've mentioned. They have expressed some concern about a department-wide investigation, and their concern is that it would be harder to recruit new officers if they feel like they're under an additional level of scrutiny. And something that the president of the police union mentioned last night is that we have about 170 vacant positions within the police department. We live in a growing city. We haven't been able to keep with the number of police that the department feels we need to keep the city safe. And it's possible that this investigation could delay a cadet training class scheduled for next year.
Cutting into the cadet class eliminates another opportunity for men and women of diverse races, ethnicities, and sexual orientation, and those of lower economic resources from joining the Austin Police Department. Since the resolution requests an immediate focus on patterns of prejudiced behavior and institutionalized bigotry, I suggest it also includes a review of the people working at City Hall who set the policies, City Legal who interprets the policies and provides legal advice, and the Office of Police Oversight, who should have taken some actions when they're initially notified of the allegations. Don't penalize the employees who are calling out improper conduct. Do the outside investigation, do the review of the recruiting and police training, but focus your efforts on the real issues and and the real locations of the problems. Please don't sacrifice our police cadet class for political theater or platform agendas.
That was Austin Police Union President Ken Cassaday. Any response from Police Chief Brian Manley to all of this?
Not that I have received so far. I reached out to Manley last night and the police department as a whole to ask what their response was and have not received anything back.
KUT's Audrey McGlinchey reporting on the Austin City Council last night unanimously voting to order a sweeping probe of alleged racism and homophobia at the police department. You can read her story about this at KUT.org. Thank you, Audrey.
Thanks, Nathan.
The city of Austin could buy more hotels as a way to provide temporary housing for people living on the street. As KUT's Andrew Weber reports, the timeline of the new strategy concerned some city council members at a meeting this week.
Last month, the Austin City Council okayed a plan to buy a motel near Oltorf and I-35 to house as many as 87 homeless Austinites. Members were briefed on a city plan to expand that strategy of buying hotels to house as many as 300 people. Mayor Pro Tem Delia Garza said she supports that plan, but she said she's concerned the city's doubling down on a strategy that hasn't proven out and that the housing could be concentrated in primarily low-income neighborhoods.
I hope as we continue these searches for these needed facilities, we sincerely do look throughout the city, because I will have big concerns if every single one of these is going to be in the majority-minority parts of our town.
Garza and other council members also expressed concerns city staff may be acting too quickly without looping in council. A memo out from city staff outlined a plan to put another hotel purchase before council at their meeting next week. Andrew Weber, KUT News.
The Austin City Council wants to take a look at the rules that let people walk down certain streets with an open container of alcohol, like beer or cider. Right now, public consumption is not allowed in a number of specific areas. Some of them are east of I-35. A good chunk of downtown is included in the area where you can't drink alcohol openly. KUT's Jerry Quijano has more on what the City Council asked for at Thursday's meeting.
They want a report on how many citations and arrests have happened over the last 10 years in the areas that you're allowed to carry a beer. They also want to look at past ordinances that prohibited consumption. Council wants to know why they were put in place and whether they've served any public function.
The current maps outlining where people can drink a beer on the sidewalk were drawn up in the 1990s, so the council is asking the city manager for recommendations on whether the maps should be changed. An update is expected in February. The Austin Independent School District is hosting its middle school fair on Saturday. KUT's Claire McInerney tells us what you can expect at the event.
It's an opportunity to learn about the 19 middle schools across the district, including special programming offered at each school. Current middle school students and staff will be available to answer questions prospective families may have. The event December 7th will be at Webb Middle School from 9 a.m. to noon. The district is providing transportation from Northeast and Travis High Schools. A bus will be shuttling from these high schools to Webb throughout the morning. Claire McInerney, KUT News.
Dr. Tim George was a renowned pediatric neurosurgeon at Dell Children's Medical Center in Austin. He died last month in Florida. KUT's Jimmy Moss has this remembrance.
Some people are driven to succeed in whatever their pursuit. Some are so driven, they even take their hobbies to another level, like Dr. Tim George.
For the IMSA Michelin Sports Car Encore at Sebring, this is competition at the highest level in the first corner of the first lap.
Tim George was in the field in an endurance race in his team's prototype race car, a relatively new class of racing for this relatively new racer. But before we get to that hobby, I want to tell you about his day job. Dr. Tim George was one of the most sought-after pediatric neurosurgeons in Austin. Dr. Neil DeGarcia is Surgeon-in-Chief at Dell Children's Hospital.
I was just in awe of this man. He is an excellent pediatric neurosurgeon who not only was academically talented, surgically talented, a leader nationally in his field, but one of the most compassionate humans I've ever met.
Dr. George was born in Brooklyn, attended medical school at NYU, further trained in surgery at Yale. He came to Austin in 2006 after 10 years mastering his craft at Duke Medical Center in Durham. He helped open Dell Children's Neurosurgical Department and taught at the University of Texas. And in all this time, he was not just mastering surgical technique. Dr. Garcia says George had a rare ability to connect with his patients.
He would always tell me, you have to take a step back and look at the patient. Look at what the patient is telling you. Look, that's how you're going to figure out what your next step is.
A sentiment echoed by Dr. George himself in a video produced for Dell Children's earlier this year.
They actually reveal a lot of things to myself, but also even to their parents, of how they really understand what is going on with them and how difficult it can be, but also they also show their hope and their spirit and their kids are just fighters.
God, he was so interactive, so open, so compassionate.
Nicole Hanover Higginbotham is a pediatric nurse practitioner at Dell Children's. She was also at Duke and was hired to work with Dr. George.
He always focused on the kid, and it would be so funny because he would ask a question and the parent would try and answer the question. And he's like, no, mom, hold on, let them answer. And he would always talk to the child and ask the child how they were doing, how they were feeling, if they understood. He explained things to the kids.
It was one of those connections that led George to racing from one of his patients.
Well,
do you want to tell the story or do you want me to?
Well, you were asleep.
Yeah, I was playing football. It was a scrimmage.
Bill Dollahite was watching his son Scott play football for Cedar Park High School in Waco when Scott got hurt.
And, I remember going down to cut block right where his knee was, and his knee came up and it hit the corner of my helmet. I was knocked out at that point. So, yeah, I don't remember too much after that.
Doctors in Waco told them he was paralyzed. The family decided to move Scott closer to home.
So we took about a 3-hour ride in the worst weather in the world to get back to Breckenridge following an ambulance. Ambulance pulled into Dell Children, or not to Dell Children, it's to Breckenridge. At that time. Middle of the night, and here comes Dr. George.
The doctor was still relatively new to Austin. Dell Children's was still under construction. Bill is not even sure if he had an office yet.
Dr. George looked at me and he goes, "You know, let's not give up everything just yet. Let me take a look at this because everything just looks too perfect." Long story short, Scott went into Breckenridge quadriplegic. A couple of days later, he walked out, and no effects from it after that. And by the miracles that Dr. George did, he gave him his life back.
That life now includes a wife and two dogs you might hear whimpering in the background because they were locked away for the interview. An interview that took place in the offices at Driveway Austin Motorsports, a racetrack founded by Bill 15 years ago. Scott is now a professional race car driver, instructor, and helps run his dad's track. And the business brought Dr. George to racing.
I got a call from his wife months later, and she said, "Hey, I just don't know what to give Tim for his birthday. I was thinking about getting him a racing school. He always said he wanted to do that." So he became our student, and actually Scott became his instructor.
That was just the beginning. Tim did all he could to learn everything about racing.
A lot of times he would come out and just hang out and, you know, help me blow the leaves off the track and, you know, just stuff like that. So
he would. This became kind of his break room from Dell Children's. And he'd come out and there'd be, you know, new students here going around. And it's after years that he had been coming out here, and he had gotten pretty good and was racing. He'd all of a sudden just step in as an instructor.
The Dollahites partnered with Dr. George on several endurance racing ventures. Scott Dollahite and Dr. George finished second in a race in Miami just in October. While not racing, Scott was adding his technical expertise to George's team in Sebring last month. About 45 minutes after beginning his leg of the race, Scott said Tim George told his team he wasn't feeling well and that he needed to pit.
Our first full course yellow, 2 hours and 20 to go.
So where the number two car stopped again somewhere.
Well, he stopped in the pit lane. Okay. Yes, he stalled in the pit lane.
And, Dr. George made it back to pit road, but not quite to his team. They rushed to help. He was evacuated to a hospital. Scott met the ambulance there, only to hear the bad news. Nurse practitioner Nicole Hanover Higginbotham will remember him as a friend and the best teacher she ever had. She says it's hard for patients' families, too, but she remembers what Dr. George said to them.
This is what he used to tell families. And this is going to be like going on the world's longest roller coaster ride. And you may not always see me, but I'm going to have a seat. Hold on. I'm going to have a seat on that ride with you, and I'm not getting off. And he meant it.
Dr. Timothy George was remembered by his Dell Children's colleagues at a special gathering Tuesday night. He is survived by his wife, two children, and one grandson. He was 59 years old. Jimmy Moss, KUT News.
In less than 1 year from today, we will know who wins the next presidential election, barring some unexpected legal battle or other complication, and which party controls the U.S. House, the U.S. Senate, and the Texas legislature. The next general election is only 332 days away, to be exact. The two big players in Texas fighting to organize political machines are the state party chairs. So Texas Public Radio's David Martin Davies called both of them up, asked them what they thought.
In past elections, Texas Democratic Party Chairman Gilberto Hinojosa remembers how hard it was to find people who would run for office.
In the old days, you know, I'd be on the phone trying to get somebody to run for some state rep slot. Usually got no's from people.
This election, things are different.
We've got multiple candidates running for not just the targeted seats, but all the seats.
Hinojosa said this is a sign of a new enthusiasm that is cranking up the Democratic Party. The chairman of the Texas Republican Party, James Dickey, sees this and he says he's not worried, but he's telling Texas Republicans to be on red alert.
That's the appropriate attitude I want people to have. I get asked frequently, is there a chance Texas could flip? And the answer, of course, is it could if Republicans take too much for granted, take voters for granted, and don't do the work necessary to spread our message and make our case.
Dickey says the Blue Wave 2018 midterm elections taught Texas Republicans a lesson. He's raising more money than ever before, hiring more full-time workers. Last election, the Texas GOP had 8 full-timers. In 2020, they will have 150.
That's one of the unique things that the party can, should, and must do, which is recruiting volunteers by the tens of thousands from all over the state and working with those volunteers to recruit and persuade and activate voters that have not previously been reached.
But the Texas Republican Party is running against some headwinds generated by President Donald Trump, who remains popular with the base of the Republican Party, but is repelling many swing voters in the suburbs, which is where the Texas GOP saw its support crack in 2018. Dickey rejects that analysis.
All of the polling that shows that the president has a challenge in Texas are, you know, have fundamental flaws in their construct.
But Hinojosa embraces it.
What we're seeing is a lot of people who, particularly in the suburbs, who have historically voted for Republicans because that was the only game in town, are now seeing the alternative in the Democratic Party, and that the alternative is much more in line with the way they believe.
Hinojosa says the Republican Party is going to try to win elections by making it harder for Democrats to vote. And he points to the new law that ends mobile early voting, which the Democratic Party is suing to overturn.
Rather than having a democracy where you increase people's opportunity to participate in this democracy, they want to decrease people's opportunity and make it very difficult for people to vote.
But Hinojosa said the ending of early mobile voting is actually likely to boomerang on Republicans and make it harder for voters in ruby red rural counties to cast an early ballot. Dickey disagrees.
I'm confident that this change will make it so the voters have much more reliability and dependability for their voting locations, and that will, in fact, result in higher rates of voting.
One thing the two chairmen agree on is about former Congressman Beto O'Rourke. The El Paso Democrat came close to unseating Senator Ted Cruz in 2018 and then flamed out in his presidential run. Both Dickey and Hinojosa said they don't know if O'Rourke is going to jump into the Democratic primary for Senate, and both said it wouldn't make much of a difference if he does. Dickey said O'Rourke shifted so far to the left running for president that he's out of bounds for Texas.
He is the worst kind of panderer and ultra-extremist leftist, and that means that regardless of what he does, it will not be a significant factor.
Hinojosa said the Senate primary is doing just fine right now without O'Rourke.
I think we got something like 12 candidates right now running for the Senate, and a great set of candidates that I think any one of which, if they become the nominee, can beat Mr. Cornyn.
Nevertheless, if O'Rourke tosses his hat into the race, he's got till December 9th to do it. That's the deadline for candidates to file. In San Antonio, David Martin Davies reporting.
Planned Parenthood is renovating its clinic on 7th Street in East Austin. As KUT's Ashley Lopez reports, it's after the city of Austin renewed the group's lease on that property last year.
It's a 20-year lease for $1 a year, and that deal with the city got attention from Republican state lawmakers this year as they passed legislation banning local governments from financially supporting groups that provide abortions, even if that financial support does not pay for abortions. In fact, the East Austin location doesn't provide the procedure. It offers contraception, STD testing, and cancer screening, among other things. Austin Mayor Steve Adler says the city has supported Planned Parenthood and its location in East Austin for more than 40 years.
There is nothing that we have done in this city that is more cost effective, that is more prudent fiscally than the city making this space available.
Planned Parenthood officials say the renovated clinic will provide the same services it did before. And while it's shut down for renovation, Austinites in that part of the city can start making appointments at a new location near the UT campus. It's open for appointments starting next week. Ashley Lopez, KUT News.
Texas went into this year with a historically tight electricity supply. So tight that some worried the state would experience rolling blackouts. That didn't happen. And as KUT's Mose Bushell reports, electric grid operators are expecting the state will have a little more breathing room next year.
It comes down to something called the electricity reserve margin. That's the amount of power that generators can produce beyond peak demand. Put another way, it's the wiggle room of extra electricity that helps ensure we don't get blackouts. And it looks like it'll grow by 2% next year. The Electric Reliability Council of Texas is the group that operates the grid. It says that increase is thanks to solar and wind farms expected to come online, along with gas plants. ERCOT says it's also improved its ability to forecast how much renewable energy it can expect. While ERCOT estimates next year's reserve margin to be bigger, it's still pretty tight compared to what most U.S. grid operators work with. But the report says it will continue to grow in 2021 thanks to a boom in solar power generation. Mose Bushell, KUT News.
Starting this weekend, Rainy Street in downtown Austin will be closed to cars and trucks three nights a week. KUT's transportation reporter Samuel King is here to tell us all about that. Hello, Samuel.
Hi, Nathan.
Tell us about this plan to close Rainy Street.
So from now through early March, three nights a week, so that's Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night, Rainy Street will be closed from 9 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. once the nightlife starts to pick up. Emergency vehicles are exempt from this, but ride shares, things like that, there will be certain pickup spots on North End or the South End of the closure. And the closure is from Davis Street to River Street. There's a couple blocks where it's still going to be open, but the main block where most of the bars are, that's going to be closed those three nights a week.
How did this plan come to be? This wasn't the original plan, was it?
Well, there was a fatal collision on Rainy Street. A woman ended up dying after being hit by a car. So that's when this conversation started up again, really in earnest. There had been some traffic studies in the past as well. So the original conception of this was a sort of a shared streets thing. And council member Kathy Tovo, she's the one who represents that area. She also introduced that resolution to have sort of a shared streets plan, which would ban cars. So she wanted that to be explored. APD looked at it and said, well, there's a lot of pedestrians here. We're talking about thousands of pedestrians on either a given Friday or Saturday night, something like 7,000. You need to just close this off altogether to just pedestrians. So the original plan that was released in November, the initial plan, no scooters, no bikes, no pedicabs, just pedestrians. So city officials heard feedback from the city council's mobility committee, some of the various advisory councils. It was like, hey, wait a minute, is there a way that we could adjust that to include those, because we wanted this to be a shared streets pilot. So they've made those changes and also pared back the closing a little bit, so adding that extra block.
How do people who live in the neighborhood feel about this?
Well, some say it's about time, while others are like, well, we're not sure that this is the way to go about it. They feel it will cause even more congestion in the area, preventing people who live in some of the apartment buildings and the like from accessing their homes, especially since you're moving the ride shares to either side of Rainy Street in terms of the closure. And so there are people with apartment buildings on that northern end. There are definitely a lot of apartment buildings on the southern end, and condo buildings, I should say. So people are concerned concerned about that. They feel the city should focus more on improving sidewalks along that stretch. There are some stretches that really don't have real sidewalks. Also enforcement and also some other things short of a full closure.
Is it possible the city could tweak this plan at all?
I think that might be likely to happen just based on what we see, especially starting this weekend. They have committed to taking a look at things. Austin police will be out there to enforce this closure. There'll be staff in the Austin Transportation Department as well out there looking at how this works. And again, this will run until early March. It is just a pilot program. It's not permanent at this point. That leads up to South by Southwest, where, as we saw last year, Rainy Street was closed for 2 weeks because of the amount of people there. So that's why it sort of stops before then, but then it's going to be closed anyway for South By.
KUT Samuel King joining us to talk about the city of Austin closing Rainy Street to cars and trucks 3 nights a week starting this weekend. You can read his story about this at KUT.org. Thanks, Samuel.
Thanks, Nathan.
This is KUT Weekend for the second weekend of December 2019. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org, email any questions or comments to weekend@kut.org, or just ask me on Twitter. I'm at KUT Nathan. Our theme music is by RAC. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org. ¶¶